I'm here with Mark Wallinger at his Delfina Studio space in London to talk about his retrospective Credo, currently on at the Tate Gallery, Liverpool. Mark, Credo represents 15 years of your work, roughly, in a variety of media: painting, photography, video, sculpture and drawing. And despite the diversity of the visual language, there is a consistency in the issues that you raise in your work. Could we begin by talking about religion and class, specifically your video piece, Threshold to the Kingdom?
Yeah, I suppose that piece started, or the genesis for that piece was through some of the earlier video works in which I sought to articulate some fairly mundane locations for their untapped spiritual potential, perhaps. And I mean, I approached one or two airports with this idea. It just struck me that the passage from airside to landside and the rigmarole that the state puts one through, and particularly passport control and customs, were somehow a kind of secular equivalent of confessional and absolution. And we shot it without permission at City Airport, and mainly because I went down there for a kind of recce and saw these wonderful smoke glass double doors that opened automatically as people arrived, and so they made rather a theatrical entrance onto the sort of official terra firma of the state. And a lot of my works have been obsessed with kind of classical perspective, if you like, and I thought if we shot this thing very symmetrically, if we use slow motion, that people's gestures assume, you know, a kind of gravitas, and they become almost like Renaissance paintings, or, you know, and the little guard on the left of the doors, you know, could perhaps be seen as St. Peter, and that actually this could be a threshold to the kingdom of heaven, perhaps, you know. And obviously using Allegri's Miserere helps rather a lot. But even the words seem to suit this. This is a sort of appeal to a merciful God, and all these people arrive tired and disorientated, and one catches them when they come from the doors at that first point of trying to find their bearing. So in working with video, if you set up, you know, a few kind of strictures in terms of structure and are fairly certain about how you want the thing filmed, then you gain a certain kind of bonus through serendipity or whatever. All those things that one can't attain in painting and other media because it's so deliberate, in a way in video, if the structure and the idea is strong enough in terms of the viewpoint, then things start happening out of that.
I think what is very interesting about that piece as well was it drew together a lot of the themes and concerns you've had over the last 15 years. And I'd like to talk specifically about the religious aspect of your work and linking together some of your video pieces, such as Him, Prometheus and Angel. You work with also the whole idea of sound in your work, this aspect almost of speaking of tongues, of reversing the voice.
I mean, Angel was the first in what became a trilogy that I call Speaking in Tongues. I became fascinated with the opening of John's Gospel, probably just the kind of sound and authority of the language as much as anything, and then...
So in the beginning
was the word, and the word was with God, and
the word was God. So
yeah.
It's a very interesting piece.
You know, it's the central kind of logos of faith, and the Word is the Word made flesh, i.e. Jesus Christ. But at the same time, if one reads it in a more modern, ahistorical kind of manner, then one could see the Word as language, and that then kind of deconstructs the very faith that text is supposed to affirm. And then thinking further about that, I was minded of Beckett's quote in the beginning, was the pun. At that point, one, you know, realizes that language stands in the same relation to the sort of objects of the world as the scriptures do to faith, that you can literally learn the scriptures backwards, but that's not going to lead you to face, the certain leap that one has to make. And I suppose, as well, kind of thinking about those satanic, blasphemous notions of reading the Lord's Prayer backwards, or the sort of, the encoded references on American heavy metal. I mean, I thought, well, what would happen if I tried to learn this thing phonetically backwards and then the final result reversing the whole film, so that I would be speaking in probably a rather stilted way, but hopefully understandable, and then everything else would be happening very fluently, but backwards. And I quite like this notion that one could, as a viewer, in the process of trying to unpick how the film was made, one is brought up short about the fact that language is just a series of noises that we all agree upon. I think it kind of leads back to a piece I did with an old Tommy Cooper hat sketch, in which I replayed that backwards, because I thought the gesture of putting on and taking off of hats, apart from being a kind of a cartoon or doggerel version of notions of identity, the gesture would be that similar, that one could then run it backwards and see what happened there. And so I mean, I quite like the notion that something as authoritative as the language of John's Gospel, once the viewer or the listener unpicked it, the kind of real event was just a man dressed up speaking a load of nonsense, really, yeah.
You play with the concepts of misunderstanding. So I'd like to talk a little bit here then about one of your latest works, Cave, your commission work that's in the Tate, because it also pulls together a subculture, if you like.
Yeah.
It pulls together your interest in sport, but also your idea of turning things on its head.
Obviously, I'm known for using sport in the past. I think originally it's because, you know, this was a central experience to, I would say, majority of people in the country that hadn't at that point seemed to be addressed. This was just something that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, went to football matches on a Saturday afternoon. And because it was essentially at that time a kind of proletarian activity, it never been treated with the seriousness that I felt was its due, and that this activity and spectacle was obviously deeply satisfying and meaningful for, you know, millions of people. I suppose the English or the British, I mean, their genius as much as anything else has been to invent a number of games that have retained their hold on quite a large part of the world. And there's something to me that seems to be in common with the qualities of the best of art, that is forever sustaining and different within a closed set of rules. And so that interested me, as well as the politics and the sociology and all the rest of it that one can attach to those activities. So with Cave, I think what appealed to me was, well, just aesthetically, what I've always found rather appealing is a boxing ring. I mean, it's, you know, a perfectly square arena in which probably the purest form of sport occurs. In the case of the knockout, the result is undeniable and as clear-cut. But at the same time, there is a kind of incidental beauty to that activity, which I think is in common with most of sport. You know, William Morris said beauty is a byproduct, and I think that's what grips people about most sport, is that once one's absorbed the rules and the ethos of the game, then what one goes for is to see people do things that are absolutely beautiful, just in the execution of beating a man down the wing in football and having the vision to put a ball 30 yards across to something. And in boxing, I suppose that again is brought to its most naked.
Yes, in that piece, you also do something you do in a great deal of your work. You bind it with references from literature.
Yeah.
You take quite a metaphysical view of it, and also you refrain from doing the climax, because at the end of it, there isn't the knockout. There isn't somebody lying prone on the floor.
No.
You also deal with the sound in a very interesting way. So you made certain decisions subverting it. Everyone's there with a desire to see the knockout, yet you don't give the audience that. So perhaps we could just talk in references of that a little bit.
What I set out to do was set up a kind of formal structure that could replay the boxing match, so that there's a camera shooting from the middle of each side of the ring that is then replayed against four walls. In a sense, you've kind of turned the ring inside out, and the viewer is in the ring. And I've slowed the action down to a quarter speed, and the sound as well, so that the sound is the actual ambient sound of every moment there. And I mean, slow motion is a kind of accepted, almost cliched part of sports coverage, but not perhaps to this degree or this length. And the sound, I think, because in actual fact we have much more capacity to identify the falsehood or the truth of sound than we have the vision. I mean, we make 24 frames a second, and the persistence of vision persuades us during a film that these are kind of real moving images, but one's working with thousands of times that information to relate sound back accurately. So the actual experience of that work in terms of sound is almost more real than the images that are flickering on the walls. And I mean, I called it cave, obviously, to kind of reference the notion of Plato's cave, and it plays a bit with the fact that just through the formal arrangement of the video projectors, one is blinded by a real light at certain points trying to look at the various sides of the ring.
I'd like to talk about Prometheus in relationship also to kind of myth and shadows, and also double meanings in your work.
Well, I think I might start by just talking about the video itself, because I think it can exist independent of the installation and as part of the Speaking in Tongues trilogy. In the video, I'm strapped into an electric chair and I'm singing Ariel's song from Shakespeare's The Tempest, Full Fathom Five, Thy Father Lies. So I had to learn to sing it as well in countertenor, because it was presumably a countertenor orchestrato who would have sung it at the time. And then the pitch is actually lowered, the visuals are still in real time. I mean, the two myths of Prometheus, the one that he stole fire from the gods and was punished by being chained to a rock and having his liver eaten out every day, which regenerated for it to be eaten out again, and also that he created man out of clay. And within Ariel's song, I think it was a rather beautiful expression of the endless capacity for metamorphosis and rebirth and creativity. In the larger context of the installation, the whole thing was inspired by a visit to Shelley's tomb in Rome, which is pictured in one of the Word in the Desert photographs, in which part of Ariel's song is on his epitaph: nothing of him doth remain, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. And I think what set me thinking about that was how curious it was to use an expression like sea change, which may have been coined by Shakespeare, but has become metaphorical for Shelley, who literally drowns. So I then went on a kind of little kind of voyage of discovery. It was one of those, I mean, I was in Rome for 3 months and didn't know quite what would kick in after that, you know. But this thing remained, and I started investigating a bit further. And obviously, you know, Mary Shelley wrote the modern Prometheus Frankenstein, and Shelley wrote Prometheus Unbound. So there was this fascination with almost creativity itself. And Shelley is documented as experimenting with electricity when he was a student. I thought about, you know, Prometheus and his kind of blasphemy against the gods, which is obviously similar to, well, everything from Prometheus through to genetic engineering has that myth of the ultimate blasphemy against nature or God or whatever you might want to call it. And then I thought, well, when man plays God, it is to destroy life as much as create it. It is a sort of allegory of creativity and the sort of temerity or arrogance that that might require, and what kind of authorities one might be offending.
But also at the end of it, you then do something with the
yeah,
sound
I mean,
the
I thought, well, to, you know, the sort of purgatory of Prometheus Chains to the Rock, I in all my work, I hope the work is self-reflexive upon the nature of the medium. And so in an edit suite, you're playing with time, really. And so at the end of the song, it's as if I'm being rewound to the start, which means that I let out this unearthly scream and it looks like I'm taking a large jolt of electricity, and then it starts again. And so it is in a sort of perfect purgatorial loop that will go on and on forever, if you let me. Yeah.
Critics often find it quite difficult to categorise your work simply because you do use this variety of media. It seems to me that there is a remarkable consistency in what you're dealing with, and almost there is a kind of moral commentary in a sense that you're obviously very aware of, but then you also take it to lots of different limits. And I'm thinking here of your fly piece, The Four Corners of the World, which in a way mark a kind of outer boundary of your work, because although they're both can be linked, they're also taking something slightly differently. I mean, obviously you could relate it to children's globes and
yeah,
things like that,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Again, that's a piece which both punctuates the show but also adds a slightly different dialogue to other work you've done.
Well, for me, actually, when thinking about what we've been speaking, it is a little parable of hopefully what might be taken to be the advantage of being open to different mediums. You know, having made this valediction to painting, and I made one painting after that, which was the self-portrait with a glass eye. Ever since then, I've been looking around for the possibility of doing something, because I do enjoy the activity, you know. And I do like doing something that feels more like a kind of 9-to-5 job sometimes, you know, and you go and you feel you've done a good day's work. So I did have this notion that it might be quite nice to make some round paintings of a globe of the world. And I found this cheap little globe in Stanford's. And I thought the dimensions of the round canvas are my Vitruvian dimensions, and like Vitruvian Man. Anyway, so I stretched up four of these things and got a photographer friend to photograph the globe against the black background. And then when I projected this globe onto the canvas, it was kind of a bit of a eureka moment, really, because and I realised I'd saved myself about a year's work, because suddenly this flat canvas was absolutely persuasively round and also seemed to have a glow that came from within it rather than projected on it. I think some people that are perhaps more rooted in following one particular medium would have carried on drawing the thing out, but I thought, well, that'll be the piece.
These themes, though, of class, religion, history, I mean, you've dealt with extensively in past work, certainly, a real work of art, your work you did with racehorse paintings, also with the Ascot piece that you did with the kind of coordination of the whole ride past of the Queen and Prince Philip. I mean, that's something that interests you as well, and also becomes very historic with the changes as it happened, literally, with the monarchy.
It's enjoying it for its surreality. You know, I mean, people that misread my work or read it as being top-heavy with subject matter are kind of missing the point a little bit. You know, getting back to what I was saying about the language of video being about time, well, being well-placed as a bit of a racing nerd, I knew that the royal family paraded down the course before the 4 days of Royal Ascot, and I also knew that the BBC covered it with such consistency in direction and swapping to different camera angles at the same point each day that I thought, well, what if we take the point where the national anthem strikes up as they reach the grandstand, there's a sort of edit point, and edit the four things as if they're happening simultaneously. And at that point, you know, what happens is something happens formally that is rather compelling and beautiful and could only come about by having a society so deferential to this mad institution. And actually, when you look at them and when you see Prince Philip doff his hat at the same point every time, they become like marionettes, and you're thinking, well, who's running who here? Who's got any kind of freedom here?
And the dialogue about the clothes. Yeah, as well. I mean, it's quite
this,
marvellous.
Just this balmy, sycophantic chatter that. I do find that one very satisfying for lots of reasons. But, I mean, essentially, as much as anything, just formally, I think it's for some reason, it's quite thrilling, because it's just this sweeping motion that is the same but different, and that seems to sustain itself over and over again, yeah. I was approached to be in a show, the title of which was Pledge Allegiance to a Flag, and I was a little bit doubtful about whether I should do it or not to begin with, because I had used the Union flag in a number of previous works, and I was fed up with the fact that because a lot of my work was to do with identity and necessarily national identity, that I was seen as being obsessed with Englishness, which then got seen to be parochial one, etc., you know. But then it just suddenly struck me that the complementary colours of the Union flag, the red and the blue, are the green and the orange of the Irish tricolour. And I remember giving a talk to the assistants and the workers in the gallery at Liverpool, and someone asked me which work might serve to express best what I was trying to do, and I thought the most succinct work was Oxymoron, in that it sought to do something that said something about the politics of the situation in Northern Ireland. You know, an oxymoron being a figure of speech that seeks to unite two mutually exclusive terms was a title I liked. It even had vague memories of Thatcher's Oxygen of Publicity, you know. But at the same time, I hate dreary work that tells me it's going to be about politics after read off a war, that everything for me has to be at first and primarily visually arresting.
Another work which I hadn't seen before are paintings you made which are like children's first primers, where you put letters together, and they've got two phrases which I really loved. Do you think I'm stupid or what?
Yeah.
Which is done in a series of letters, and the other one, what do you hope to get out of me? For me, they linked a lot of your work.
Yes.
So much of your work is about the language of how we communicate.
Yes.
The language of in the beginning was the word. And I love the way that they punctuated the show. And there's a kind of a lyrical quality of things linking up.
And they do serve a sort of pivotal role. But they were, at the same time, a kind of valediction to painting. I mean, I call them question paintings. And they all are questions in which there is an object and a subject, and the questions are of the slightly kind of irritable end of relationship type. So the first one was actually called Do I Have to Spell It Out for You, which I think is quite nicely complete, and the rest of them kind of follow that lead. There's some sneakily inserted bits of autobiography in my work which are buried low down, but I mean, what was nice was to give myself a rubric in which, you know, I had to use 25 squares, 5 colours, no 2 squares with the same colour on each other. So they punctuate the show and the catalogue. So how much do you think I'm worth? It's quite a nice thing for a painting to say. What do you hope to get out of me? Why do I do these things for you? Etc., yeah.
But also, as you say, the beginning and a closing of something also,
yeah.
Because there are often phrases that are used,
yes, yeah,
when something's,
yeah,
ending or,
yeah,
something's,
yeah,
beginning.
Exactly.
That so, questioning.
Yeah.
Your work is very much about questioning various aspects of, if you like, the bigger issues of life.
Yes.
Where do we go?
Well, I mean, I did decide pretty early on that, you know, I wasn't interested in signature style and the rest of it. I think painting is now either an indulgence or a craft, and painters are a bit like what potters were before, really. It's not through that kind of assertion that I stopped painting, really. It's a really felt thing that the whole history of Western painting and then through modernism is a kind of trajectory that one can read essentially formally as well as many other ways, but there was a way in which every version of the language exhausted itself somewhere in the 60s, and that it's impossible to make unironic paintings. It's impossible to come to that thing afresh without, you know, at the very least, unconsciously pastiching something that one's taken on board as denoting something that, that someone originally had struggled to find a new way of saying something. And so there are limits to how arch one can be before it becomes painful.
I'd like to kind of address the issue of how obvious to you is self-referencing your work, referencing to other works, and whether there are some aspects you can think of where you've definitely thought, well, this leads into another theme or another work.
There's one or two strategic decisions I made with my career. The Racing Sojourn was an attempt to pull together different themes and examine them within a kind of world within a world that I found intrinsically fascinating to begin with. I suppose because my work has appeared to be rather eclectic, I felt I needed something that would serve as a way of sort of corralling things into a box, and I became rather bored of situations where I'd be driving past a field and there'd be a horse in it and someone would say, yeah, well, Mark, you know, pointing at a horse. You know, I kind of wanted to draw a line under that, and in this exhibition as well, hopefully make a statement about my work that would have some interest in how these things sat with each other.
There's so much religion in your work, or themes of religion. I mean, does this come from quite a religious upbringing you
had?
Is this just something that you find as kind of intellectually interesting?
I think, well, both my parents are atheists. They're kind of good liberal people, so they did send me along to Sunday school because they didn't want to deny me the possibility of of that kind of experience. And I got bored by the fact that we were just colouring in pictures and we weren't really learning anything about what all this meant. But I mean, I should say that I wrote my dissertation at college on James Joyce's Ulysses, so a lot of my concerns are Joycean, but without the kind of guilty baggage of being a kind of dyed-in-the-wool Catholic trying to find a way through art. But I think his notion of epiphany is something that I can't shake loose from, and I kind of identify that as well with Freud's notions of overdetermination. I always try and find points at which a nexus of ideas, both spiritual and more down-to-earth and political, meet, so that the possibility for transcendence is always undercut by so-and-so or so-and-so. Again, it's a bit like sport. Religion is something that has become a kind of non-new subject, and yet majority of all our laws and our customs, the way we conduct our lives, are based on Christian values, and Christianity is predicated in a belief in the supernatural. And you don't have to go very far from the House of Commons and to that notion, you know, and the head of the church is the Queen. And it's like, ooh, yeah, but we don't see those things anymore. But they're there everywhere still.
There's a friend for little children above the bright blue sky, a friend who never changes, whose love will never die. Our earthly friends may fail us, change with changing years, this friend is always worthy of that dear name he bears. There's a rest for little children above the bright blue sky, who love the blessed Saviour and to the Father cry. Our rest from every turmoil, from sin and sorrow free, where every home for little children above the bright blue sky, where Jesus reigns in glory, a home of peace and joy. No home on earth is like it, nor can with it compare, for everyone is happy, nor could be happier there. There's a crown for little children above the bright blue sky, and all who look for Jesus shall wear it by and by. A crown of brightest glory, which he will then bestow on those who found his favour and loved his name below. There's a song for little children above the bright blue sky, a song that will not weary, a song continually. A song which even angels can never, never sing. For they know not Christ as Saviour, but worship him as King. There's a rope for little children above the bright blue sky, and a harp of sweetest music, and palms of victory. All hold above is treasured and found in Christ alone. Lord, grant thy little children to know thee as their own.
I'm here at White Cube Gallery with Runa Islam. Runa Islam's work engages with the nature of film and its projected artifice. She plays with narrative, perception and film language to produce open-ended cinematic moments. Runa, I'd like to begin by discussing your new film installation, Director's Cut, Fall for Love, which is currently showing here. Now, it's based on a Sam Shepard 1975 play. First of all, what made you choose that? And then I'd like to talk about the way it's installed here. Sure. And the narrative language in it.
Okay, as a starting point, it probably was actually almost the kind of additive that, you know, I had all the intentions to make this play, but I was looking for the material to work with, because originally I wanted to write my own script, which is actually very, very difficult and demanding, and there's kind of certain talents that I maybe have, but I don't think scriptwriting is one of them. So I found myself 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you know, before the kind of critical point of filming, looking for something that could embody my work, and the work could embody, you know, could kind of they could work together, but that I couldn't, I didn't really want to work, you know, and I was looking actually for about 5 hours in the National Physics Bookshop for a play, and I, you know, came across like favourites like Pinter or Wilde, and then, of course, they have such kind of intrinsically, you know, sewn in narratives that if you want to break those apart, you're working with a whole different dimension of, you know, our culture and literature. So I thought maybe something like Ibsen, maybe something more contemporary, maybe, you know, I just kept looking and I was going from A to Z, and I came across Fool for Love by Sam Shepard, and it was brilliant because I opened the book, read three lines, and it was something like, you know, where you gonna go from here? And I thought, that's exactly what I want. This kind of cardboard cutout, very generic, you know, universal sort of male, female, love story, a breakdown. And of course, you know, you can literally read it in one go. So there are, of course, very sort of subtle twists. And Sam Shepard works in that way, that you can complicate a simple event. But he sometimes, you know, only has like three very, like, essential dimensions. But, and I'm not saying it works simple either, but it was brilliant source material. So that's how I, you know, came across it. And presented it to the people that I was going to work with, and you know, the character sort of grew out of that. And of course, when you watch the piece director's cut, you're not getting the whole play. Of course, it's just like, you know, almost used as a resource to sort of embellish the idea that something is in progress. So I don't know what Sam Shepard would think of it.
It's very interesting when you do watch it. It's on two screens. And the various different viewpoints that you employ, the various different camera angles. So you start to engage with the different characters and you literally become, I feel, like an understudy in it. You're almost wanting to say the lines, and when the director is directing it, like saying it this way, you're almost thinking, yes, say it that way. You start to really engage with it. That's very much been part of your work, hasn't it? Using different camera angles, getting the audience to see the different viewpoints. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. And works that I've made in the past that sort of almost are commentative on filmmaking process, but it's not really to break down cinema as something that I think exists very separate to art and very successfully. But I think in the arts kind of arena, you can debate the visual language of cinema and the art, you know, the artifice, the real time that's recreated time. So you're talking about, you know, two parallel times that work together, and that could be I could be watching myself, you know, returned, you know, at like a mirror, but of course we know that one is captured and one is real. So often my intention is to break down these modes to alert attention to, say, what is realistic isn't real, and what is captured can have fictional sort of properties that we as spectators give almost a sense of belief to, and that's where a work can exist in our imagination. And with the double screens, it's you know, multiple perspective, but I've made other works where I have intentionally tried to say, you know, it's a overall objectivity. I want to look at how you can how you can address something almost cinematically, something subjectively, something personally, something as if you were the camera person, as if you were the actor, as if you were, and it's like almost giving every character a personality and a position. And in director's cut, my use of double screen actually was quite, I find it very important to the work. Of course, you could dispense with double screen projections often, and I resist to like embellish works with many perspectives just for the sense of the aesthetics. So what I've would like to point out in director's cut is because there are many binaries working. There's the actors working with the director, then there's myself as the director working with the director. There's the filmic and the theatrical. There's the understudies and the main actors. Then there's like the male and the female. Then there's like the script and then the original play. So there's all these double, you know, parallels going on, reflections going on, almost like refractions. But for me, it's the double screen takes on board not just multiple double perspective, but it's quite like considered in the way that I've tried to use film to capture time that can be repeated. So you'll notice that sometimes you have the same moment twice, and it's all filmed on one camera. So you're talking about this double time, this diachronic time, and when you have these sort of
affinities between the work when they synchronise. So you have a synchronic one time. It's where the work becomes three-dimensional and very much where the resonance of the work lies. And for me, that's possibly like the sort of premise of the work, is to have to break things down and at points to build them back up. So at these points, it's where the work and the art almost lies. So that's with director's cut, you know, these sort of many voices. I mean, the same person talking twice and talking totally, like, you know, sort of different sentences. And then one word overlaps and you feel like that's a synchronised moment where that word really, really exists. It's like giving it three-dimensionality.
Also, your work is about portraiture, this one as well, this work, Director's Cut, where the actors become portraits. You mentioned the filmic, the real, the constructed, the acted. That is very resonant in the work. As you, if you watch it several times, you see that the characters of the actors, they start to bring out their own characteristics, particularly when they're saying, I love you, I hate you, the different ways that the actors relate to those phrases, and the way that you use close-up. Close-up is something else you've worked extensively with in your work.
Yeah, I mean, it's like something that's not determined, and I haven't intended, you know, to make a series of portraits, but looking back, it's probably the most common sort of uniting element that I've always managed to somehow capture, you know, a person. And it's hardly the case that I've worked with professional actors. So almost every work I've made is somehow through a friend or friend or someone I've just met. So I've worked principally with, you know, characters in my work, but portraiture seems to have come out in the process that a lot of people who have been involved in my work are not hired as actors or actresses, but have actually been people around me at the time. So it's not just it is a case where they've become a character in my work, but if I look back now, you know, different places I've been have captured different people in my work. So, you know, when I was working in Amsterdam, there's friends that were around me in the Rijksacademy, or when I was doing screen tests, it was just a few people that I, you know, asked to get involved with my work, and then a couple of friends arrived from abroad, and they came with another friend. It was like, would you like to be in this work? And what's quite incredible is this, you know, encapsulating these characters, and they then exist separate to themselves, you know, and my interest often is, you know, you can get somebody on, you know, film for 2 seconds and it can become something totally poignant and, like, even detached from them. And often I found that people said, we didn't do anything. And you say, thank you so much for, you know, being involved in the work. And it's like, well, we didn't do anything. But, say, in Director's Cut, of course, that, you know, I tried to activate this idea of a very specific character, a type of behaviour. Could you embody the script? Could you reenact the script? So in that case, portraiture probably didn't come out of just a silent depiction or silent sort of portrayal of somebody, but I actually wanted them to then become a character. And I was last year sort of working with an actress who is a friend of a friend's, and I was asking her questions about, you know, at what point do you embody a character? Do you think it's visible? And I'd love to find that fragile sort of periphery at the point where you go from real to embodying the sort of make-believe. And what I've tried to do in Director's Cut is work with between these different sort of peripheries and fringes and borders, you know, going from the real to the unreal, going from what you could be led into believable, then you hear my voice coming in and interjecting and kind of going, cut! So all the trappings of a real theatre, you know, a very authentic theatre rehearsal are sort of undercut by my directing. And then, of course, if everything exists for the film, then at what point were these people really emphatically, you know, in their characters? And at what point were they just themselves? So there are, you know, different sort of, you know, ways, like you mentioned that when you have the I love you, I hate you scene, the way that the different characters reacted is so remarkable that for me it's this amazing sort of idea of the rehearsal being a place where the behaviour, you can restore a type of behaviour just by asking somebody to say these lines.
Now, you're involved also currently in a project, Please Disturb Me,
yeah.
Wonderful title, where you've done, again, a video work, room service.
Mm.
We talk about that because that started from a very specific set of instructions, didn't it, where you all got together in the hotel, I believe, and made the filming of the piece.
Yeah, Please Disturb Me was this proposition from Simon, who's I've worked with on another project, once we were on the same show, and he said, you know, there's a possibility you can stay in this hotel, which is this wonderful new sort of hotel, but it is a bit of a city gents hotel, so it's kind of a place that you wouldn't end up if you're an artist, but it's wonderful architecture, you know, it's done by Conran, and it's got all these sort of great modernist sort of features within this old Victorian building, and for me, I just thought, great, I'd love to stay in a hotel in London. It's not the first thing that you get, you know, get a chance to do. And he said, and you need to respond, and this the show will be about six artists responding to the environment, which, in fact, is quite restrictive. And I think, you know, there's a lot that you can't do and a lot you would like to do. And then, of course, I went through, like, 8 or 9 ideas before I came up with the room service work, you know, just I was trying to manipulate the way that you respond to the obvious surroundings. There was one piece that I thought about as you enter this incredible rotunda that's like, you know, 6 levels of sort of circles cut through the building, and I thought it'd be wonderful to place a mirror on the floor in the lobby, and you know, as you walk in, you're just sort of like suspended into this vertigo because above you is the sky, sort of light, you know, 100 feet up, and then you're actually just there, reflected, kind of descending down into this hole, which was a really nice way to sort of literally disturb your feeling of orientation. And also, you know, with hotels, you know, you go to hotels around the world and they're almost the same. And even though the Great Eastern Hotel prides in the sense that no room is the same, there is a generic that you can't get away from. So my intention finally sort of came out of just, you know, thinking of all the things that hold the work, the place together, and similar to a lot of my other works, it's what goes on behind the scenes or what's happening, what are the structures that hold these things into place. So, you know, if in director's cut it's the way that, you know, even in the set you can see the way the structure of the set is made, or and you see like a clapperboard coming in to start the film off. In room service, the piece, it's about the chambermaids who are there to kind of hold the sort of decorum of the hotel up. They're the sort of you know, almost the emissaries of the hotel, and they're there to do anything you want them to do, serve you, be servile, be pleasant. And I just thought it'd be hilarious to do a piece about these people, you know. And there was numerous, sort of, many different sort of ways that I could have approached it, but in the end, the piece that you saw was about two sort of quite, you know, sort of naughty chambermaids who end up, you know, indulging in exactly what they're meant to be, kind of providing for other people. And I sort of was encouraging the girls who were working with me on that night to be as sort of subversive as possible.